Bigfoot, Nessie, Chupacabra. Are these and other purported monsters the real deal? Or are they really not more than a fantasy of those who want to believe? We'll ask those questions on The Cryptid Report.
Welcome to The Cryptid Report. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And I think we're going to have a fine show today. We are going to talk about sand, and sea serpents. Our guest is David Goudswart. He is a historian, editor, and author, having written or co-written more than 15 books on topics ranging from H.P. Lovecraft's travels to ancient stone ruins in New England. He is the author of numerous articles on local history topics, a frequent lecturer on historical topics and the craft of writing. You will hear him on many radio programs, television programs, and we are so glad to have him with us today. David, welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I was reading in the introduction of the book, you said something along the lines that the book is more centered on Florida, but that's almost because Florida has a better PR agent.
What did you mean? Well, they used to have one anyway.
What did you mean by that?
Well, the Caribbean Isles, as an example. People are going to go to Bermuda or the Bahamas, whether or not somebody sees a sea monster. Florida, in the time period we're talking about, which is before air conditioning, you came down here for the air or the heat. You didn't come down here because you wanted to see the art. You didn't come down here because you could sit in an air-conditioned room and look at the beach. You came down here because you had some sort of a health issue, and that's what they were promoting. Then that became a land boom. But at no point is anybody saying, gosh, I got to go down there just because I enjoy 90% humidity and 95 degrees. Go figure. So what happens is these hotels, which are so dependent on the snowbirds, start looking for things to make them stand out from other hotels down here. And what they discovered was that if you had a choice between a hotel that had a genuine imitation garden from Europe you could wander through in the twilight, or somebody had seen a sea monster off the coast, they'd go for the sea monster. And it got to be a running gag down here, particularly in Miami, that they knew it was tourist season because that was when the first sea monster sighting showed up.
So it was basically kind of a hype thing to try to get tourists and get people to increase hotel occupancy.
Yeah. Yes. And it is a situation where, unfortunately, they have a tendency to, let's politely call it hyperbole. They really like to make the monster bigger than it was. And this is still going on in Florida. If you were to check a fishing newspaper down here, which, yes, is a thing, you would find nobody pulled in a really big fish. Nobody pulled in a marlin. They reeled in a monster. They pulled in a sea serpent. And so it gets to the point where it's almost interchangeable in people's minds that a really big fish is a sea monster. And a sea serpent is also a sea monster. But a sea serpent is not a really big fish, or at least that's how the theory goes.
Now, I know one of the things, as I understand it, that you're very big on, and I applaud it, is doing your research from original sources. Can you explain to people the concept and why that's so important?
Well, I'll use a specific example. That's always a good way to explain that. Otherwise, we'll be here for 3 or 4 hours, because I'll go right into professor mode. There was a sea serpent sighting in the Gulf of Mexico. It was a Norwegian ship going to Texas, and actually the area where they spotted this had seen 3 or 4 earlier reports, so they were almost primed to see something. They go to Texas. Nobody cares. They turn around, go back to Florida. Nobody cares. They go back to England, and this particular freight line was struggling a little bit because basically Texas to England really wasn't that popular of a freight line. So when the captain mentioned he had seen this sea monster, he thought, well, maybe we could get some publicity out of this. So he let it go. Then he accidentally let it go and slip out in France. His logic being that if the story comes from France, it doesn't look like the freight line itself is being the promotional material.
Mm.
So the French, I tell you, these guys had way too much time to think this stuff through. So the French newspapers run the article, and the French newspaper article is picked up by the scientific journals in England. And of course, that's when our freight line picks in and just sort of runs with it. But the article in England is so badly translated that it sounds like this ship, and it's a Norwegian ship. And I stress that because I'm coming back to it, ran across some sort of this 300-400-foot serpent roiling around in the water. It had a crescent-shaped tail, and it had some sort of a membrane on its back. If you know your rudimentary dinosaurs, the Dimetron, just this big sail on its back. And that's the report they went with. Now, cryptozoologists are going, huh? Which is the technical term for it. but even somebody like Bernard Hevelman is not, he just says, well, this is obviously either a hoax or so elaborately written that it's obviously unidentifiable, and just sort of tucks it in a corner of his book. What I did was I went back to the original French newspaper and translated it myself.
Right.
And what I discovered was that, as an example, the membrane is not the English word membrane. It's the French word membraire, which is basically the ribs of a ship, the parallel wooden lines inside the ship that the planks are attached to. So the captain is using nautical terminology to describe what he saw. You use that piece of information. He's seeing something that has parallel lines on its side, and it has a tail with a crescent shape. What he's describing is a group of orca whales bubble fishing. Now, at that time, they had never seen that. Officially, bubble fishing would not exist for another, I think it's 30 years before it was scientifically written up. But the fish start swimming in a large circle, and it's a group effort, and they start expelling water and bubbles underwater, which drives the school of fish toward a central point. And they just keep making the circle smaller and smaller until the concentration of fish is so great, then they attack. This is a normal behavior, but it's so badly written up that you can't tell it's a whale, never mind a whale doing a behaviorism that at that point was undocumented. In fact, if this had been properly translated in the first place, it would be the earliest reference to bubble fishing among the whales. What I also discovered was that despite the fact that we're talking about a article in France badly translated by English, there were material published interviews with the Norwegian crew who had scattered since then, but they had a chat with the captain, they had a chat with the first mate, they had a chat with several of the others, and they're all agreeing. We didn't make it up. We don't know what the heck they were talking about in that article, but we've been on the ocean more than a couple of days. It was nothing supernatural or cryptozoological. It was just business as usual on the ocean.
Now, there's an old saying for something to be real, it only takes one. So let me ask you this. It sounds like, from our discussion so far, that the vast majority of these reports going back are maybe people taking more than a little bit of creative license with something.
Possibly a wee bit of rum as well. But
is there the possibility of that one, or of one that maybe is as fantastic as they make it out to be?
I am not a zoologist, certainly not a marine biologist, but I have noticed a pattern, which is kind of my thing. And what I have discovered is that if you get rid of all of the sturgeon and alligator gars and 12-foot penguins, we'll come back to that one, undoubtedly. What you find is that off the coast, and we're talking Brazil, Central America, Florida, up into the Carolinas, there seems to be one consistent set of reports that I don't dismiss. I can't dismiss them. I can't tell you what they were. But they appear to be a dark green or black serpent, 50 to 100 feet long, moves in a serpentine fashion, is not afraid of a sailing ship. In fact, if you fire a gun at them, they get a little cranky. But there are reports of a 100-footer and a 50-footer, which to me suggests a breeding colony. Now, where this gets even weirder is I've started work on the New England sea monsters as a follow-up book, and the same reports go up the coast, including the most famous serpent of them all, the Gloucester Harbor Sea Monster, or if you prefer, the Cape Ann Sea Monster. 1819 to 1834, seen constantly in that area around Cape Ann, sunning itself on the rocks on occasion, in the water, trying to avoid the ships, but it was actually a social phenomena, because there are hundreds of sightings. People would pack a picnic lunch on Sunday, go down to the shore, take out their periscope, or a telescope, a periscope probably wouldn't help, but take out the telescope, and just have a lovely afternoon having a picnic lunch and looking for the sea monster. And then it continues up into the Maritimes. Now, this is very odd to me, first of all, because that's a heck of a range for one critter. But more importantly, once you get up into that area, you can't say, well, it's just one creature following the Gulf Stream. Gulf Stream crosses over into England, Ireland area. We're talking about sightings in Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland. That is cold water. So what we seem to have is a 50 to 100 foot social animal, serpent in nature, possibly a snake, possibly not, but that is impervious to water temperature, which almost suggests that it's warm-blooded, which is even more nonsensical when you say it out loud. But they're there, and it's almost an archetype. There's no variation in these sightings. You'll see one or two that are dark brown. There's one they found down in Bahamas they claim was chocolate brown, as an example. But again, it's all dark colors. So is that a sea monster? I don't know. Is it that eels used to be a heck of a lot bigger? I don't know. Does it mean that motorized sea craft tend to scare away these creatures, whereas sailing ships did not? Again, all I know is I can date them back to the 1634, the very first cryptozoologist in North America reports one of these serpents coiled on the rocks in Cape Ann. And this is 200 years before the 1812 spike in sightings of this critter.
Well, here's the thing that I would say. I've always felt this, and it's kind of funny for a guy who one of his shows that he has is called Cryptid Report, but I tend to be a little more skeptical about cryptids, particularly land-based ones. Not that I'm ruling out, not that I'm saying they're impossible, but I tend to be a little more skeptical about them than other areas of Freudian research in the anomalous. However, within the broad category of cryptozoology, the one area where I think there's the most interesting and I believe the greatest possibility for there really to be something to it is waterborne creatures, because we know less about those type of creatures, particularly the oceans, when you're talking about the oceans, than anything. I've heard it said that we know less about the deep sea floor than we do about outer space. So to me, the idea that you have, particularly again, oceans, you have these vast bodies of water, who's to say there isn't something very, very strange living in them? Now, that's not to say what you're saying, you know, people ginning up things to draw tourists in the vast majority of cases, that makes sense too. But it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. It could be both.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And a lot of it is still misidentification. We've moved beyond people misidentifying a alligator gar as a sea monster. That's a popular one. We had in the last 20 years, somebody report a monster that turned out to be a manatee mating group. And apparently it takes more than two to tango when you're a manatee.
Oh my goodness.
I did not know this. And I was perfectly okay not knowing this, by the way.
Yes. Disturbing visual, but never mind.
But you think of a manatee as this big, slow-moving, lumbrous creature. Apparently, when they are properly motivated, they can really move. And as a result, this sighting, which I believe was Clearwater area up on Tampa Bay, was by people who did not live in Florida, or were newcomers anyway. And they filmed it, and you can't see. I mean, I've seen people claim it was anything from a manatee being attacked by a snake to an alligator attacking a anaconda, and it's like, now that's too much roiling around in the water. That's a couple of manatees. And they tried their best to sell this as a sea monster account until anybody, and again, I'm not a marine biologist. I have no background in zoology. I am a historian. Even I know when it's not a sea monster.
Now, you kind of teased us with that discussion of the 12-foot penguin, so you have to tell us about the 12-foot penguin.
Yeah, everybody loves the 12-foot penguin. I almost have to take a deep breath before I start this one. In the 1930s, Clearwater was a small town in Tampa Bay. To give you an idea how big it was, the nearest big town was Dunedin. And if you still haven't gone for a map, you know the area better than even I do. But they had a couple of famous practical jokers in town. These are the type of guys who would wait until the church meeting at night and then sneak out to the parking lot and change the hoods on all the cars, which you could do very easily in those days. And nobody would know at night, so they'd get home, and then the next morning, you know, their blue car would have a yellow hood on it, things like that. You know, that was their idea of a big weekend.
Oh, wow. No Netflix.
No, and it would have helped right now. One of them got it in his head that they should do something, because there had been a big dinosaur footprint discovery out in Colorado. So they said, we should do footprints of a dinosaur. And they put a lot of time and effort into it. I will give credit where credit is due. They tried plaster. It doesn't hold up well when you strap it to the bottom of a shoe and try to walk on the sand. They eventually ended up casting iron into the shape of a three-toed, quote-unquote, dinosaur footprint, bolting it to a pair of sneakers. Somebody would put them on at the shore. They'd go out in a boat. They'd go down to the public beach area. He'd hop out of the boat, walk along the beach for 10, 20 feet, and then go back in the water. First time they did it, nobody saw it. They misjudged the tides, apparently. Second time, they got smart. They anonymously called the police and said a monster had frightened them on the beach. The local police go down there. They see the footprints and go, our local practical jokers are at it again. So from the very beginning, the locals knew what this was. It was a prank. The problem was, this is a tourist town. And while the locals knew what was going on, the tourists didn't. And as a result, you've got this town which is horrified when the Tampa newspapers start carrying it. Clearwater, like most of the bay, had been decimated the year before by red tide. They had had they were all bordering on bankruptcy. The last thing they needed was a sea monster on the beach. And they were afraid that this was going to scare them. It turned out, instead of scaring off the tourists, it brought the tourists. So these guys would go out every so often and, again, go out in a boat, come on the shore, walk along the beach, and then go home and laugh about it. And it started going national. And it went national. And then it went international. And that brought it to the attention of a New York reporter who was starting to make a name for himself. He was doing a nature program on one of the radio stations. He was starting to do TV appearances with live animals. His name was Ivan Sanderson.
Oh, yes.
Ivan Sanderson, basically, one of his first sea monsters was the Clearwater three-toe. The monster kind of quieted down, and that's as far as it went. And then it showed up again elsewhere. And specifically, when I say elsewhere, the Clearwater is on the far western part of the peninsula that is the Tampa Bay. This showed up on the far eastern, and it was along a river, and it was in the clay and the sand, and it just happened to be a resort. And the guys who did the footprints did not know this at the time, but the resort was by a retired Hollywood media specialist who said, oh, look, a marketable commodity on my property. I'm paraphrasing. And he went national with it. He used all of his contacts, and he went national that the Clearwater monster was back just in a location 120 miles away. And that's what brought Ivan Sanderson down to visit. Now, by the time he got here, the situation had changed a little bit. People had taken plaster casts, and he took casts as well. And initially, he thought it was a hoax. In fact, his first newspaper article on Three Toes says it's a hoax. But then he tried to recreate the footprints, and he could not get it to work.
Mm.
But what he had not calculated was that the footprints had been made in the mud when it was wet. By the time he got there, the mud had dried out into almost cement, which means there was retraction and it was a harder ground. So if he put on his own set of footprints and tried to walk on that clay, he could not recreate the footprints. Of course he couldn't. It's an entirely different terrain. It's not soft and muddy. It's hard packed, sun-baked. Yeah. So he started rethinking. And he decided it might have been some sort of an unknown animal, bipedal, obviously. But he spent months charting out the footprints to figure out how tall it was and how much it had to weigh to make that type of weight. And again, all of his information is based on these false footprint data. And he eventually comes up with that he thinks it's some sort of a small dinosaur, which is what they wanted in the first place. And that's as far as it went. The footprints would show up every so often again. In fact, Arthur C. Clarke was in Clearwater to learn how to scuba dive. And they actually showed him the footprints. So sometimes even the tourists were in on the gag. And they would do this anytime there was a new reporter for the newspaper who fell for it every time, or a cryptozoologist, or anybody who kind of was, you know, there's no monster. Well, here's the footprints again. About 10 years later, out of the blue, Sanderson decides that it must be a penguin that left these footprints. Now, mind you, there is no indication in his newsletters or his books prior to this that he was changing his mind. You know, first it's a fraud, then it's a cryptid. Now it's a 12-foot tall penguin, because only a penguin that big would weigh enough to make these footprints. And in some ways, this declaration, which it, for obvious reasons, got picked up immediately by the press, kind of was the beginning of the end for his credentials as the go-to guy for sea monsters and Bigfoot and anything else you had. He kind of loses a lot of his glamour after that. It's particularly when you realize it is only today, modern times, that they have discovered penguin fossils that are 7 feet tall. So they still have not ever seen any evidence that something that big existed. Wow. But it still gets rolled out every year, like clockwork. The surviving gentleman of the Practical Jokers brought the footprints out. He strapped them on. He showed them how they worked. When he died, his son kept them and actually let Mysteries at the Museum borrow them for a segment on the Clearwater Three-Toe. They have a plaster cast of it in the International Cryptozoology Museum up in Portland, Maine. This is made fresh from these footprints in the last 5 years. In fact, I was at the conference where Lauren Coleman was presented with this cast. And yeah, it's still showing up everywhere as 12-foot tall penguin. Now, which is kind of why I can't use other people's cryptozoology books as source material.
Right, right. So really that goes back to that importance of using those original sources. Now, is there one, I know we talked about that long possible eel or serpent or whatever it might be. Is there another one that we still hear about today that may actually be representative of some real kind of substantial creature?
It's hard to call that. The example I use is muddied water syndrome. The St. John's River, I'm going to stick with Florida since the book is out and I'm more familiar with the material.
Sure.
But there was a sighting of a sea monster or a critter. I don't think it's a sea monster, for approximately 12 seconds by four people on a boat. It stuck its head out of the water and then it disappeared. That's the entire sighting. It was bubblegum pink. It had loose fitting skin, and it almost sounds like something had died and floated to the surface temporarily and disappeared. But again, I would actually have to do more research into the forensics of dead animals in the water. But it got national attention. And as a result, all the other sea monsters, sea serpent, cryptid, I don't even know what word to use in a case like this, all the other sightings in the St. John's River, and it's 300 miles long, keep in mind, became the same monster, even though Pinky, quote-unquote, was only seen for those few seconds. So further up the river, there's a big green something sighted. They call it Pinky anyway. There's a big gray thing spotted, which is probably a manatee. They call it Pinky. there's somebody who's seeing the classic neck sticking out of the water, you know, Loch Ness Monster right. surgeon photo.
Right.
And it's pinky. Now, none of these are pink. There's only one that's pink. But everything in that river is now called pinky. So when you ask me, are there other monsters that I think are legitimate? And the answer is, tell me what pinky is. Is it the manatees up the river you're talking about? Is it the occasional seal that comes in the river? Is it the giant amphibious somethings, the snakes down in the Treasure Coast area, which is the headwaters of the St. John's? Tell me what is a particular cryptid. I'll tell you what the viability is. But the problem is everything's getting grouped together. The giant octopus of St. Augustine, which is near and dear to my heart, because it actually has H.P. Lovecraft connections to it as well. But that was just bits and pieces of a whale that had floated ashore. It became a technical term, a globster, which is something Ivan Sanderson phrased. And they come ashore every so often, and they've been tested DNA. It's an unknown creature until you run the DNA, and then it's not an unknown anymore. But that doesn't stop them from washing ashore. And more importantly, it doesn't stop people from claiming it's the remains of a sea monster. In other words, I'm stalling here a little bit because I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, you know, we talk about a lot of things on these shows that we'll never know the answers to, or certainly not in my lifetime, for sure. So it's always interesting, though, and I love that balance of saying, hey, you know, sometimes these things are just exaggerated, and sometimes in maybe lesser cases, there may really be something to it. I love that balance of intellectual honesty and curiosity, and that's what we've gotten today with David Goudsward. He is the author of Sun, Sand, and Sea Serpents. David, where can people find the book and more information about everything you do?
Well, the book is available in a number of locations. Obviously, Amazon carries it because it wouldn't be a book if Amazon didn't have it. It is also available from the publisher, Anomalist Books, at their website. My website is my last name, goudsward.com. You can order it directly from me. But because of the COVID situation and me being in the epicenter of it, I don't get out of the house much because the hazmat suit's a little sweaty. And as a result, you can also buy it from the International Cryptozoology Museum up in Portland through their gift shop if you want a copy that's signed. As far as I know, that's the only place you can buy an autographed copy. It's also signed by Lauren Coleman, so it's a double whammy.
Very cool. He did the foreword, yeah. Indeed.
Yes.
Well, it's been a great discussion, David. We'll love to have you back, hopefully, to talk about that New England book you mentioned you're working on. And we thank you for being a part of the Cryptid Report today.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning into the Cryptid Report. And I'm sure David would agree. Keep exploring those mysteries. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.